your attention over to Acts chapter 17 this morning. Lord willing, tonight, I've been working on this past week, the minor prophets again, and we'll get back to that, and it's time for the book of Micah. So the Lord willing, tonight I will be preaching on the book of Micah. I have to continue that series. But this morning I want to take a look at a passage in Acts chapter 17. You remember that Paul ended up in Athens. Those of you in our adult class may recall, as we did the introduction to 1 Thessalonians, that we studied these verses in Acts chapter 17. In fact, I think Josh referenced Acts 17 and 18 this morning, so this still comes up occasionally. But in Acts chapter 17, you have Paul leaving Thessalonica. He ends up in the bulk of basically the second half of the chapter in Acts 17. He ends up in Athens, and of course, ends up at the Areopagus with the opportunity to preach that sermon on the one true God. But before the sermon, you remember he arrives at the city in verse 16. His spirit is stirred within him. Some Bibles I noticed have the word provoked. Spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was wholly given to idolatry. And so this is the backdrop to what we're about to see in verse 18 of Acts chapter 17. Somewhat of a reaction by the people to the main topic of discussion. And I want to look at a word here in Acts chapter 17. Acts 17, 18 says, "So some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, 'What does this babbler wish to say? What will this babbler say?' Others said, 'He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities.'" You know, I always thought it's funny when you're reading, and I've used King James pretty much all my life. "A setter forth of strange gods," King James. "A setter forth of strange gods. Seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities." Why did they say that? Because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. It is kind of interesting, all of the different observations that are made in Acts chapter 17 about Paul and what he was introducing here to these people. You know, they weren't used to this idea. They were used to deities. As we just noted in chapter 17 and verse 16, the city was wholly given to idolatry. They were used to deities, the concept of deity, or I'll say little g, gods. They were used to that. They were very familiar with that. What about the idea of a deity dying, being executed, being put to death, coming back to life, and then being king over the world, being sovereign over the world, all authority given to him in heaven and earth? What about that concept? Well, that would be what? Verse 19. That would be a new doctrine. That'd be a new doctrine. That's something they weren't. That wasn't in their literary circles. They weren't hearing lectureships on that. And verse 32 ends up saying, when he preached on the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. Some mocked. Well, that's what they were doing earlier. The Stoics and the Epicureans, that's what they were doing when they said, "What will this babbler say?" We need to understand, in order to appreciate what's going on here, we need to understand the word babbler. The word babbler. What does it mean? It's a Greek compound word. And the two parts of it are from sperma, which we get the word seed from, and then the word Lego. You know, the kids know what the Legos are. You know, Legos do what? They connect each other, and they're typically collected. I think that's funny. The word Lego means to collect. Seems like all my grandkids that get into Legos, there is no end to the additional sets of Legos that can be added. And then Caden and them, they have a big table over there full of all these collected Legos, and now they just go off on their own with their imaginations. I like that better. Rather than following the plans of each particular set, they make massive projects with them. So think of Lego, think of collect, and then sperma seed. So what does this suggest then? Well, among the people of Paul's day, it would be used of crows or birds. Right now I'm thinking of turkeys, since I was watching 9 of them yesterday in hopes that they would wander close enough to my area where I had my bow to kill one of them as turkey season opened up. And crows, turkeys were out there in the field just plucking away at what? Seeds and insects. Seeds and insects. Crows do that. Other birds do that. So it was used commonly of birds picking up seeds. So this is what they called Paul. All right? But then, of course, it was used accommodatively in the marketplace there in Athens, and I'm assuming in other places, of a man. Of a man who would linger there, lounge there, and hope that maybe some one of the wagons is there pulling through here, pulling their carts of stuff, food and other things, that grains that they would sell in the marketplace, something would fall off on the ground, and then they would pick these things up, these scraps that fell on the ground. So it was used of that. So you think in terms of today, you know, we think of a parasite. We think of a sponge, someone who sponges off of the labor of other people. Or you think of a hanger-on, a loafer, a slacker, words like that. That's actually not exactly how it was used here. It was used metaphorically. So here's the meaning. We've talked about the meaning of the word. What if you made a metaphorical application of that for this context here? This is how it's used here. Would still be scraps, but it would be scraps of information. And that's what they did in Athens. They spent their time either to hear or to tell some new thing, verse 21. They were about information. Wouldn't they have loved the internet? They were about information. And they would give these speeches, and they would applaud each other. They would be impressed with something that someone had come up with or heard somewhere. So maybe Paul is one of these types. W. Vine had kind of an extensive definition of this, a plagiarist. That is, he'd heard things from lectures and speeches in other places, and he takes pieces of it and he tries to impress people. He maybe kind of sort of pastes them together, and he maybe wants to impress people with what he knows. To make a show in unscientific style of knowledge obtained from misunderstanding lectures. Do people ever do that kind of thing? Regularly. So we could relate to the metaphorical use of this. But I liked the final statement here seemed to fit perfectly with what we're reading in Acts 17 in verse 18. Maybe Athenian slang. After all, this was Athens. And so they may have sort of accommodated a use of a word and applied it to one who was outside any literary circle. I think that's what's happening here. I think that's how the word is used here. That seems to fit very well. The context, the reactions, the comments that are made in context about Paul. So he's saying things they're not used to hearing. And it's not like they could go find one of their old books, one of their old wisdom literature books of the Greeks or the Athenians, and look up these things and see where Paul sourced this. This seems to be outside of normal literary circles. And so they think this guy is crazy. What will this babbler say? Now, I stumbled across this passage recently in studying something else, and I thought, I want to make a sermon on that, out of that, because actually, that happens all the time to us. That's how we're seen. That's how Christians are typically seen on certain key issues. They are crazy. That's just a bunch of babblers over there saying things they have no basis in reality and science. That's unscientific. That's what they say. Now we're treated this way. Back in Micah, when I was studying Micah, incidentally to what I was working on here on this lesson, in Micah chapter 2 and verse 6, you have a little window into what the prophets of Micah's day, the false prophets, the pagan prophets, said about the true prophets. And the New King James translates a word that could be prophesy there, but it just means to speak something, and translates it prattle, prattle. He prattles. What is prattling? Well, that's just worthless speech. It's just empty speech. It's meaningless. There's no real substance to it. That's Micah chapter 2 and verse 6. What did Festus say about Paul in Acts chapter 26 and verse 24? Paul, you are beside yourself. You have lost, it means you have lost your mind. In other words, your mind is not running your mouth. You've lost your mind. You're beside yourself. That's what he said to Paul. What did Ahab think of Micaiah? I think we could have a sermon just on this. In 1 Kings chapter 22. He was upset with Micaiah because Micaiah never prophesied anything good concerning him, but always evil. The prophets have always been ridiculed. God's spokesmen have always been ridiculed. Jesus was made fun of. They mocked him for what he said during his public ministry and some things on the cross. And so this is how that works. People speak on behalf of God are often classified basically as babblers. And sometimes, this has been an interesting development to me in some areas. Sometimes you see Christians, truth teachers, truth speakers, ridiculed, made fun of, mocked, in areas on topics where they've been proven to be right. Pat and I, this gave me this idea for this point in this sermon, something that Pat and I were talking about recently after services. The studies that have been coming out on alcohol. Now, while these studies, and I saw a guy the other day on one of the powerful podcasts, and they were talking to him about his position on alcohol. Some very influential man. I forgot his name. I meant to research this and see if he'd written anything. And he was talking about, from a health perspective, how damaging alcohol is. And they said, what degree or what level of alcohol consumption then did you limit? Do you limit yourself to, or do you suggest that others should limit themselves to? He said, 0%. Zero alcohol is the only safe level. And I'm going to make a point on that here in a little bit. Now, Pat and I have talked about this because all these studies are coming out, and meanwhile, what? I've never seen more gospel preachers flock to a position at one time than I'm seeing right now. You know, it used to be if you're going to have a gospel meeting, you need to talk to a man about his position on divorce and remarriage because there was so much error on divorce and remarriage. We might say, okay, do you agree? Before we pay you, we can't write you a check. We can't write you a check and you hold a false position on some doctrinal issue. Something pertaining to the salvation of the soul. We're not talking about some misconception. We're talking about whether or not they're teaching, preaching, hold a position that is soul damning. That's why we talk to them about divorce and remarriage. I've done this many times. If I didn't know them already and know what they wrote on it or what they preached on it. And then things come up like the issue of the divinity of Christ, and some said Jesus was just an ordinary guy like you and me. He's not going to be preaching a meeting here in this building. We can't write a guy like that a check and pay him to teach soul-damning error. You know, so there were these issues, and we would go over these with people and say, okay, where do you stand on it? If we didn't know them, where do you stand on these things? Can you believe that we're now going to have to ask preachers whether or not they believe that social consumption of alcohol is okay. That's where we are. We will have to do that. If we don't know their position already, that is like me, where you're out there on the internet with all kinds of material on alcohol. Whatever I've said on it is out there, you can read it. Maybe they're like that, we can just look that up and see where they stand. If not, we're going to have to find out. Because there are so many preachers who have now compromised. And I know why they're doing it. It's all a numbers thing. It's all a matter of the size of the church where you're preaching. If you want to keep it large or make it large, you will compromise on alcohol because so many brethren are compromising on alcohol. The new position is, well, as long as you don't get drunk. That's not a new position. That's a very old liberal position. So that's what made me include this point here. A lot of preachers have been just made fun of. You know, I read something the other day where a preacher, I used to think he was a sound guy. Andy knew him. Andy Soaker knew him for years. Well, he's come out now saying, oh, the Bible only condemns drunkenness. It doesn't condemn the social imbibing, drinking of wine or beer, or even whiskey in small portions. Yeah. Well, he's off the list for coming holding me. I might debate him. I'd be willing to debate him anytime, anywhere on the subject, but we won't be inviting him, writing him a check to come here preach a meeting for us. Because he's off on that. And we, for years, were sort of made fun of for our position condemning the consumption of alcohol. Well, now, of course, some have compromised. Too many have compromised on it. But we would cite passages that are so clear, and I'm not going to take the time to analyze these. I've done that before. In fact, not maybe a couple of years ago in a sermon. But these are the kinds of passages we would talk about. You know, 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3. And we talk about the different levels of drinking. Three different Greek words are used there in that verse to describe three different levels of drinking, all the way to the last one, potos, which just means sipping. Sipping of the wine. Why is exactly parallel to social drinking? Social drinking is specifically condemned in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3. Though that's a behavior that characterized the Gentile world. Verse 4, they speak evil of you because you don't run with them to the same excess of riot. Speak evil of you, we've already talked about that. Title of the sermon, Paul was called a babbler. A babbler. Chapter 5 and verse 8. What did Peter instruct in 1 Peter chapter? What did he charge the brethren to do in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8? Be sober. That's the first admonition. Be sober. Then the next one, I mentioned it was interesting. I was talking about prayer recently and made the point about watch and pray, or pray in watchfulness. The two are, you know, quite frequently associated together. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, it says, be sober, be vigilant, be watchful. Because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. He's concerned about only one thing, destroying your soul. Now, what tool might the devil use? Well, anything that would keep you from being sober, sober-minded. Sober-minded means clear thinking. One of the things I've noticed that lexicographers on this, dictionaries that define things like Vines and others, W. Vine and others, they will always include alcohol, free from the use of alcohol, because alcohol damages one's ability to think soberly. In fact, don't many people, if you say the word sober, and I realize that the Greek word is not limited to just free from alcohol. I understand that. I've studied the Word from multiple sources. It's just that it includes that. It includes that. And some would like to strike that from the definition. No, this is just, you know, this is just clear thinking. Yeah, that's our point. Alcohol damages the ability of beginning immediately upon consumption. The ability of one to think clearly. With this, just this morning, Josh was doing a great job on class, and we were talking about this idea of unreasonable men. Unreasonable men. People become unreasonable when they consume alcohol. I've seen it all my life. So we talk about verses like this. We talk about Ephesians 5:18, technically there. That use of what's called an invective verb. An invective verb which takes a process back to the beginning of the process. Ephesians 5 and verse 18. Do not drink wine which leads to dissipation or drunkenness, your Bible may have, but be filled with the Spirit. It describes the process back to the beginning of the process. When does one begin to be drunk? How would you answer that if you didn't have a verse of Scripture like this? Well, when he first begins to drink the alcohol, he begins the process of becoming drunk. I'd like to hear some people actually answer that, who defend social drinking up to the point of drunkenness. By the way, does that include up to the point of, you know, being at a party and putting the lampshade on your head and running around like a fool? Does that include that? At what point would it stop, I wonder, for them? Let them answer that. They can't answer. I can answer. I can answer it because I have inspiration on my side in Ephesians 5. What about Proverbs 20 to go with that in verse 1? We sometimes talk about wine is a mocker. Strong drink is raging. Those who are deceived by it are not wise. What about Proverbs 23, verses 29 through the end of the chapter? They talk about this process of drinking where people consume alcohol, they first start looking at it, you know. And every time I read this passage, I think of the alcohol commercials that emphasize the look of the drink, the color of it, the movement of it. Pictures, people spend tens of thousands of dollars for things to be photographed to make, and they do this with hamburgers and other things, cheeseburgers and other things too. So, but what's the point of that? To get people to drink it, to get people to eat it or drink it, consume it. In Proverbs 23, it starts with that, but then it ends up the guy, man, wakes up and he feels like he was beaten. What happened to him? Well, he probably fell. Felt like it was in the top of the mast, you know, shaken. He's hungover. Probably has injuries sustained at a point when he didn't even realize that he had injured himself. That's what that passage talks about. We've talked about those. All of a sudden, and this has been very interesting to me, studies have come out. What will that babbler... Is that babbler going to keep talking against alcohol? What will that babbler say on this? Well, what have we babblers said on this? I just gave you a little piece of some verses, just a few, just a handful, out of a Bible of passages that I use on this when I'm preaching on it, and others that preach like I do against the use of alcohol. What have we said? We've said that there is no safe level of alcohol consumption. I wonder if anybody's saying that now. I started collecting news reports years ago, and it took me forever to find them. But I found, I think, most of them for this sermon. Kept finding things like this over the years. Even 2 to 3 beers a week may cause brain changes and cognitive decline. 2 to 3. How many people who drink beer drink only 2 or 3 a week? People will drink 2 or 3 in an hour, but they won't drink 2 or 3 a week. What are they doing to themselves? This was a study in 2022. Do you remember when they said, well, but people, and especially older adults, can benefit from moderate consumption of alcohol? I remember the 80s and 90s. I kept running into this and talking with brethren. Well, hadn't you heard that moderate consumption of alcohol is good? That's what they kept saying. Until the more recent studies on this, and there are many of them, where there are no benefits, it is always only negative. And particularly with older adults, because of the increased, radical increase of the likelihood of cancers. And when I say cancers, there's a long list of body parts that are affected. You know, it's not just esophageal mouth cancers where the immediate contact of ingesting the alcohol is killing and damaging cells. It's not just that now. It's everything in the digestive system and then everything affected by blood. That's your whole body. That's your whole body. It goes straight to the blood system. Alcohol immediately gets into your blood. And we know about this now. We know the consequences. Virtually, you won't be able to see this. I'll read it to you right under the Boulder font. Virtually any amount increased the risk for cancer, and there were no heart benefits, the researchers reported. That's a little different than what we were told for years. And you know, brethren, they had really adopted some of the earlier thoughts on this. They ignored the Bible. Now, I know what you might be thinking. Well, Tim, you can't use one research and ignore the other research. What about research that harmonizes with what holy inspiration says? Which one are you going to believe? Which one will you believe? These confirm what we've been saying, what we babblers have been saying. Look at this study, Washington Post study, more recently, this year. Study links heavy drinking to brain injuries, Alzheimer's. They keep trying to figure out why there's this increased rate of Alzheimer's. Increased risk of Alzheimer's. Why more people are developing it? What about people who consume alcohol? Down in the body, I wish they'd put this right at the top, but down in the body of this article, and that's why I made the little caption in the red there, guess how much alcohol, how many drinks, constitute, per this study, heavy drinking? Wouldn't you think the guy that buys a case of beer a day or drinks a bottle of wine a day or a bottle of whiskey, wouldn't you think it would be something like that heavy drinking? I would. I would have thought that. I'm reading along here in this, refreshing my memory on it and why I saved it in the first place. 8 drinks per week. It didn't say 8 drinks a day. You would have thought it would have been 8 drinks a day. Heavy drinking, based on what you see a lot of times. I mean, sometimes you'll be at a restaurant just kind of, you know, scanning the crowd and see people who are drinking alcohol. And be people just in a restaurant while they're eating a regular meal drink 4 or 5 glasses of wine or 4 or 5 bottles of beer. You'll see that regularly. 8 alcoholic drinks a week constitutes heavy drinking according to this study and leads to Alzheimer's. Some people are critical of WHO, and I have been on some things. I remember some of the rulings they made on COVID, the World Health Organization. I also noticed that on some things, politics are not involved with them. That's a good thing. Because typically, lobbyists, the alcohol lobby is very powerful. In almost all human governments, alcohol lobbies are very powerful. And many congresspeople representatives, senators, others consume alcohol. It's just a known fact. And you know, I always thought it's interesting that in Proverbs chapter 31, it is not for kings to drink alcohol. Solomon's is not for kings. Lest, what? They forget the law. I like it when our legislators don't drink. I like it that President Trump doesn't consume alcohol. I like that. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. Some have thought to make fun of him for that. And I thought, why are you making fun of him for that? We need all of them to quit drinking. All of our civil leaders to stop drinking. That would be good. But who did this massive study on this? The risk and harms associated with drinking alcohol have been systematically evaluated over the years and are well documented. The World Health Organization has now published a statement in the Lancet Public Health. When it comes to alcohol consumption, there is no safe amount that does not affect health. Alcohol, now listen to this, is a toxic, psychoactive, don't we know this just from anecdotally? Psychoactive, you see how people are affected by alcohol very quickly, and dependence producing. Oh, that sounds like Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 35. When shall I awake, the drunkard says, I will what? You remember the last words of the chapter? I will seek it yet again. Alcohol is addictive. It's highly addictive. Alcohol is highly addictive. So he said, dependence producing, or they said, substance, and has been classified as a group 1 carcinogen. And what are we talking about there? Cancer-causing agent. By the International Agency for Research on Cancer decades ago, this is the highest risk group, which also includes asbestos. Oh, we can't work on that house. It's got asbestos in it. What are you worried about? Cancer causing? Radiation. Radiation. And tobacco. Alcohol causes at least 7 types of cancer, including the most common cancer types, such as bowel cancer, female breast cancer. And he goes on to describe why ethanol does what it does. Basically because it gets in your bloodstream. What will this babbler say? Don't you feel good to have been classified with Paul now as a babbler? These reports just keep coming out. This does not include the one of the guy I was talking about that had done the study on this and is sort of blowing up the internet on this. And has some very influential people really thinking about alcohol now. Maybe this guy's right. I've not seen anything good come from it. I've not seen any good benefits from it. You know, we babblers were criticized. I have been. For emphasizing God's design for the home. God's design. And what are we talking about? Well, a marriage. A male and a female. A man and a woman. And then, typically, a family. We think of Psalm 127 with the children gathered around the table. Or Psalm 128 in verse 3. It talks about the wife and the children. Blessed is the man who has his quiver full of them. That passage. We'll look at that. We think of verses like that. Why have we done that? Well, everybody knows, and this is something that has been said many times by various people of different backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, non-religious backgrounds. Why does it matter? Because the home is the most fundamental unit in society. Most fundamental unit of society. Where there are sound homes, you're going to have a sound society. Where there is a breakdown in the home and breakdown in homes, you're going to have a breakdown in society. Steve Bannon just said, I believe it was yesterday, that England is headed for all-out civil war. Now, he was talking about the influence of Islamism. That's the word I used, or use, the Muslim religion. What it's doing to society. You know, if you're a young woman in England right now, you better be careful where you go and when you go there. Rape is off the charts. Young Muslim men will rape a non-Muslim woman in the service of God. Rape to a Muslim is a good thing if the person you're raping is not a Muslim. Think about that. Yeah, I'd be headed for civil war there too, living under those conditions and not even apologize for it. The argument is pretty much over. The time for the argument is over when you get to a situation like that where people behave like animals. Again, 2 Peter 2. That's why that popped into my mind so quickly this morning. I've been thinking about this again. When people start behaving like animals, they're unreasoning, they're unwilling to listen. You cannot reason with them. You can't sit down with a Bible and go over the scriptures. They hate the Bible. Then there will be other ways of addressing this. I'm afraid that's where it's headed in a lot of places. And if we don't watch it, that will begin to impact our culture here as well. It already is in some states. Think of Michigan, Minnesota. Of course, divorce must also be blamed for some of this. I need to quit on this here. I'm out of time this morning. God, what does Malachi, since I put this chart up, this point up, what does Malachi 2:16 say about God, the Lord of heaven, what his view of divorce is? He said, I hate it. He hates putting away. He hates it. Why is that? Well, because of the damage that that does to people, of course, but the souls of people, but also the damage it does to the environment, to culture, to society. It destroys the home. Anything that destroys the home is beginning to destroy a people. A people. In Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 34, that's the passage on that. The nation that does not respect God. Judgment is eventually coming to those people. And some of those judgments are physical. Go back to the Old Testament. There are some judgments that are physical consequences that are built into behavior. So we think of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. It fell from within, not from without. We think of other countries and nations of people that no longer exist for this same reason. I have a few more things to talk about on that. What will this babbler say? One of the points that I'll be making has to do with how we have been perceived, how we've been portrayed as a result of what we teach on that basic old plan of salvation. What will that babbler say on that? Listen to what that babbler is saying on that. He said that baptism is essential for salvation. He said that the God's scheme of redemption includes not just belief, but also baptism. I wonder what else that babbler might say. I was thinking there are two ways to look at this, just from the perspective of a couple of verses later in Acts 17 where it says, he brings certain strange things to our ears. You could look at it from just that perspective, probably will on this point. But you know, it hit me, I was thinking about this yesterday, how many times now I've seen these mass baptism movements. Well, they're going to the sea. Out in California recently, there's one of these. Thousands of people were baptized. Now, they weren't baptized scripturally, sadly. At least, they weren't taught scriptural baptism. We would hope that maybe some of the baptizees, some people who were baptized, did believe and understand the truth. And maybe they were baptized for the remission of their sins. But been a big baptism movement. Nicole Shanahan, the tech gal, tech lady. She was, I saw her talking about her conversion. She was immersed in baptism. And I found that interesting. Very interesting. A little more attention given to that. I thought we were just babblers for talking about that. Just babble about baptism. Hopefully that grows into a Bible-based movement. Wouldn't that be great? We don't want them to just be immersed, though. They need to be converted. Mormons are immersed. Baptists are immersed. They immediately go into the practice of error. They're immersed because they've already received the remission of their sins, not in order to receive the remission of their sins, but they are immersed. They were baptized. That's what the word baptized means. There has to be other teaching with that in order for the baptism to be conversion or to be involved in conversion. This morning it may be that yours would be. You understand the truth. You want to be converted. It does include baptism. If you want to be converted, that's going to be based upon a change of mind. This is going to include godly sorrow because of sin. 2 Corinthians 7, 7 through 10. Godly sorrow. Not that I just, you know, I just want a change in my life. I just need a different direction, a change in my life. Not just that. Now, the change that I would be wanting is because I have hurt God. I have not lived up to the glory. I've fallen short of the glory of God. That would be the reason. But if that's your reason today, we want to help you. We can assist you in your conversion. Assist you in your baptism. If you need to obey the Lord, come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.